Christy gracefully said yes to this, and I'm super excited about this because you have a really amazing story that I've heard bits and pieces of, but kind of like both Osborne and Richard, it's really good to sit down and just get all the details on the table. But I've been inspired by your life really for a long time. We've known each other now for, I think, 15 plus years, close to that, you guys have been attending the church. And I think that probably you and Tom, your husband Tom, are probably, you're like the student who sits in the front of the class, because everything that we do as a church, you guys jump right in and really lead the charge. And it's been so inspiring for me to have that kind of support as a pastor. And it's really amazing to just to hear, just to know bits and pieces of your story and how that's motivated you and inspired you to get involved in so many of the ministries and things that we are doing around here. Our mission is because the world needs people who live like Jesus. And I really believe that you live that out in incredible ways. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let me just ask that you would start. We started most of these stories with, give me your origin story. Okay, so the young Christy Lynn, growing up, what was it like? What was your faith journey like when you were young? Give us a snapshot of that period of your life.
Okay, I always start it with, I was born into the Assembly of God Church. So I was born into Christianity. Not that I believe that you are saved because of that, but I would say I probably had no other choice in that matter. But I was the last of four children. My family was raised in Arlington Assembly of God. I was the last of four, meaning the other three were quite a bit older than I. My sister's 4 years older. My brothers are even older than that. And some would say I was an afterthought. Some would say I might have been the postman's child, but DNA proves I'm not. So I am my father's child. But I grew up in the church. I grew up playing in the church, hearing the word of God, the flannel graph stories. I mean, it was a no-brainer that I would believe that I was a sinner and that Jesus Christ died for me. And so I accepted him probably around 4 years old into my heart, and then continued on that pathway. And very early on in my childhood, disruptions began. My father went blind when I was probably 3 and a half due to diabetes and other things. And then the next big memory in my life was the day the police came to arrest my father for sexually molesting my sister and abusing all of me and my siblings. And that began a journey of things that would go on in my life that would make me question who God is and where he was for me in those times.
And this is a theme that's come up, I think, in just about every story that we've really processed through all three of these weeks, is that so oftentimes we grow up in these church environments or these, you know, Christian homes, and sometimes it's those who profess Christ and those who, at least on the outside, are professing Christ, who do the most damage to our faith, because we look at that and we say, well, if you say you believe in Jesus and you did this to me, or you're capable of this kind of behavior, then what does that say about who Jesus is? And we talked about this last week with Richard, because he had the same kind of a story. He grew up in dysfunction. So how did you overcome that? Or was it difficult for a while? Was it kind of like a reason for you to kind of, hey, I'm not going to be a part of this. I don't want to have anything to do with this. What was your reaction to that?
So initially as a child, there was a church family who, I did not know this, but had been kind of asked to surround me, and they did. And I became another child in their home. And basically I went to their home every weekend. I spent I went on every family vacation with them. Their dad taught me how to swim, sort of. And so I was around another Christian. Yeah, he threw me in the water. That's how I learned how to swim. But nothing like just being thrown in. And I was around them. The the children's program and then the youth program again just sort of wrapped themselves around me and kept me involved. And I wouldn't say I knew it then, but I see now that that was God basically continuing to surround me and saying, not every Christian is like this. Mm. And so that became very prevalent in my life, that his voice was just still there, even though I had a big example of what not to be. Mm. His voice continued.
So I think, you know, I mean, I grew up in a Christian home, church, going to church, all that kind of stuff. But I think for every person who's had that experience, there's a moment later on in life, right? And there's a moment in which that faith really becomes rooted in your life and is your choice, is your personal experience. When did that happen for you?
Fast forward. And my senior year of high school, probably late junior year, I visited another church with my best friend, and I met a guy who became my boyfriend, who was yet to become another not great example of a God-fearing man. But I believed he was. I believed that he was a God-loving man, that he was there to guide me and lead me in a way my father, my earthly father, had not. I got pregnant my senior year. I dropped out of high school. I married him and then continued in a 10-year domestic violence relationship, which I will give you the Reader Digest version. I can see the times that I was on my knees before God begging him to make my husband love me, to make him treat me like Christ loved the church. And it never changed. And I came to a point where I then began to pray, God, just kill me. Just end it. And I can't tell you the times I fantasized about how to kill myself, how to open a door on a freeway and fall out of the car. Every time I held a knife, that knife had a different purpose for me. And yet I couldn't do it. And it culminated in my husband actually trying to kill me. And 3 months later, I took my daughter in the night and ran. It was after that that I actually left church for a few years. I just couldn't fathom how God could have deserted me when I was praying and giving when I had money to give. And I was a Sunday school teacher. I was a choir member. I was all the things that you're supposed to be. And I kept wondering, where is he? Where was he? Fast forward again. His voice just continued in my life. As I'd be driving, he'd be saying, I'm here. And I'm like, but where were you? And eventually I started going to church again. And as I started going to church and starting to heal that relationship of just listening to others preach his word, his voice got louder and louder. And through healing, through what I call a forgiveness journey that I went through in therapy, I found that he was there when I couldn't see him. He was there when I couldn't hear him. He is what saved me from killing myself. He is what didn't allow my husband to be successful in killing me. He is what who brought me out and found me an incredible man, Tom Reddy, who would love my daughter, a daughter that was not his own, but would love her as if she was. And he is who brought us here.
And so, you know, I only want you to share what you're comfortable sharing. But I want to go back to, you know, those 10 years while you are in the midst of that marriage relationship, because I know this is a big part of your story. You know, you get married very young. You're in a very dysfunctional, abusive relationship. But your faith, it seems, is still there, right? You're still struggling through this, working through this. How do you hold on to that? Or is it just like, there's a storm going on and you're just hanging on for dear life to the only thing that is going to keep you afloat? But I mean, what is your relationship with Jesus like during those years? Are you surrounded by people who are supporting you still? Are you feeling all alone? Like, I mean, what's the dynamic that you're going through there?
I was not surrounded. In that time, a lot of it was behind closed doors. A lot of it was private. A lot of it was not told. I was embarrassed that I, you know, couldn't keep my husband happy, that I couldn't be the submissive wife that I was repeatedly told if I was just submissive, God would bless us. But there was times as it got worse that I literally went to a pastor's wife at the church we were at and talked to her and shared what bit I felt safe to share, alluding to the fact that he was violent, that he was destroying things in our home, physically slamming, breaking. And I was told by her and then by one of the associate pastors, the young married pastor, that if I would just pray harder, that if we would tithe, that if we were obedient to God, God would bless our marriage. And I remember thinking, I just kept doing it. I just kept doing it and kept doing it. Everything they said, I kept doing it. When I left the marriage and that church, I didn't speak to people from that church for a long time. Honestly, I blamed them more than I blamed God. I blamed that they didn't listen, that they didn't reach a handout, that they didn't speak up for me. Some of you know I'm writing a memoir, and when God is ready for it to be published, it will be published. And right now my title is, that's not okay. It's not okay that we don't listen, that we don't reach out, that we don't help, that we are not Christ to others. It's not okay that we're not.
So I think you've answered my next question, but maybe you can elaborate a little bit on it. For everybody who's been through that, or for everybody who has a person in their life that's going through something like that, you just described three ways that the church responded that was not healthy. And I definitely would hope, as a church leadership, that we've learned from some of those lessons of dysfunctional responses to situations like that in the past. But how do people who love somebody or who are in somebody's life like that, how does a church community respond to a person who's going through what you were going through in a way that genuinely helps them come to a place of healing? You mentioned listening, and you said actually, you know, showing up in their lives, being a presence in their lives. What are some practical ways that that you can really be there for somebody who's going through something like that?
Listening would be number one. If someone has the strength and ability to say, you know, there's abuse going on in my home, or I'm afraid to go home, or if you notice they just don't ever want to go home, that's a sign. If they don't want to go home, I couldn't wait to get to work on Monday, and I hated to leave work on Friday. So if someone doesn't want to go home, there's something going on. So listen, and honestly, tell them you believe them. Whatever they say, I believe you. I see you, I hear you, I believe you. And then what can I do? Ask the question. They may not know, but they might. They might just be waiting for someone to say, what can I do? If you can take them in your home, take them in. If you can't, find somebody who can. Sit by them in church. There is nothing that would have upset my abusive husband more and silenced him as if somebody would have just came alongside me. When I left and people did come alongside me, then he shied away. But when he had me alone, that's when he was powerful. So just be by them, be near them, be that presence that makes the other person realize that the woman or whoever is being abused is actually not alone.
So you finally get out of that situation, you escape out of that situation. What are the next few years like? How do you recover from that? I'm sure that the first few years were just shell shock and trauma. But what happens next? Because, you know, your story is a turnaround story. It's a redemption story. What were the first steps towards that recovery process?
Well, if I'm completely honest, the first year I spent doing all the things I had never done. I am not a holier than thou person. I am not a perfect Christian. I spent a year going to the bars, going dancing, exploring what, you know, I got married at 17, so exploring what I missed. And thank God he was there through that with me as well. And then he, actually, I was out dancing and I met Tom. So in my dancing, God brought Tom in. And
can we strike that from the record?
Sorry, I'm not against dancing. Okay, I'm just not. But so we met. And again, I'm telling you, God finds you. You may walk down that wrong path, like you were telling us, and he finds you, and he's with you, even in that. And I met Tom, and we, like I said, began dating, and he met my daughter. My daughter fell in love with him. He fell in love with her, and I fell in love with the whole thing.
How many years was that after?
I left December 18th, 2001, shortly after 9/11, and I met Tom January 3rd, 2003.
Okay.
Not long.
So, yeah, so he's responsible for your entire recovery. No, but what else was going on there, right? I mean, you know, we all know Tom is an amazing human being, and I'm sure that was a big part of the healing process. But what other things were you doing to try to, you know, heal and recover from that? Because, I mean, I can imagine as a pastor, if I was in your guys' lives at that point, I didn't come along until later, but I would be like, hey, we need to do some counseling here. You know, what were some things that you were doing during that time? Because by the time I had met you guys, you know, things were going pretty well.
Yeah, they were. So initially when I left, my bosses, I had gotten a job. He also got me a job, which became the way for me to get out. Mm-hmm. Like financially became the way. And that was all God, because it was an ad in the newspaper. I was not allowed to work unless my husband wanted me to work, and then I was only allowed to work as long as he wanted me to work, and then I had to quit jobs. So anyway, he one Saturday had circled an ad for an apartment manager job. I went and interviewed for it, even though I lied and said I had graduated high school because I hadn't. They hired me, I got a job. Long story fast forward, they ended up falling in love with my daughter and I. They saw in me an ability that no one had ever seen, and they began to train me in their office as in accounts payable, in accounting, asset depreciation, things that I had never learned. That became a job that they gave me. And then when he tried to make me quit that job, I went in and gave them a half story as to why I needed them to make sure I didn't lose that job without telling them what was going on in my home. And they listened, and they helped me keep the job. So anyway, when I left, I moved into one of their apartments in the middle of the night without telling them. So then I thought they were going to fire me because I took a key, I moved my daughter and I in, came to work the next day and said, hey, I'm living in one of your apartments. I expected to get fired, but instead God had a plan. And they surrounded Lori and I, and they, you know, not only reduced the rent so I could afford it, they went and had their son bring a car back from Vegas so that they could sell it to me for cheap. They just did all these amazing things. In that process, I began to see that people were surrounding me. Now, mind you, they're not Christians. Non-Christians surrounded me by the grace of God. And that also tells you that God can use whoever he wants to use. It's not limited to us. He will use whoever is willing to follow his direction. And so they surrounded Lori and I. They became a prevalent part. Lori and I did get into therapy immediately. And we were in therapy weekly for a long time, and then off and on for the course of the 10 years. And it was in that therapy, and then when I started going back to church, that, you know, things started to align as to where I saw that God had been present when I hadn't heard him. That the things that God had done to save me more so than to fix the situation. So it taught me things like sometimes God isn't going to give us the answer that we want, but he's going to give us the answer that we need. And then I had to battle the belief that, you know, I was raised, you don't get divorced. Divorce is wrong. You know, unless my husband had cheated on me, where's the verse that says, you know, thus, except for adultery, it's you're married forever. And I battled that for a long time. And I sought God. What do I do? I'm not supposed to be divorced. I'm getting remarried. It's adultery and all that. And I came to an understanding amongst myself, and I can't give you scripture to back it up, but I firmly believe that God, who created me and loved me, did not expect me to stay in that marriage. That he wanted me to be loved, that he wanted me to know love, and he wanted me to love. And I believe that. So that healed, you know, my relationship with him, that the God I know and love wants me to be whole, happy, and healthy.
Amen. So you mentioned in a short sentence there that you went back to church. I'm trying to figure out how you were able to do that. Because I think there probably was a lot of bitterness. So what was that, just that rebound back into, you know, the sort of environment that I think easily you could have blamed and pointed the finger and said, this is the reason, and blown out, because a lot of people do. They blow out of church, they blow out of community, they give up on it, and it permanently affects their relationship with God, you know, because we're meant to live out our faith in community. So how did you do that? And what was that process like for you of trying to recover this part of your faith that is critically important?
I couldn't stand to not be there. I can only say that I have always known since the time I was that little girl, 4 years old, I've always known who God was. I may not have understood all the beliefs. I may not have understood the rules that we were meant to follow. I've been through, the Assembly of God was a little more spiritual and speaking in tongues, prophesying, all those things. And then the Baptist church that I was in when I was in the abusive marriage had a lot more legalistic, black and white, dyed in the wool, Bible thumping things. And I didn't understand all those, but what I knew was I knew God had made me, and I knew that I loved him, and I knew I believed in him. I just knew it. And so not being in church, there was just this piece that was missing. Yes, I didn't like what the church body had done. Yes, I didn't like what the pastors had done and ignoring me and feeling abandoned. And what I kept thinking was it was the people that had abandoned me. It wasn't God that had abandoned me. It was the people who had failed me, which also you could say, okay, then I'd be mad at church and be mad at pastors and be mad at Christians. But honestly, what I looked at it was they were just as human as I am. I may have felt like the worst person. I got pregnant at 17. I dropped out of high school. I got married. I got divorced. I had promiscuous relations. I got married again. I had all these things that were check, check, check. I'm a bad person. But they're no different than me. They had abandoned me. They had ignored me. They had left me out. God doesn't look at my sin as here and their sin here. Sin is sin, period. It's equal. And so what I looked at those people as I felt sorry that they had missed an opportunity to be used by God. And I wanted to get back to God, which meant forgiving and letting go of what had been done or not done for me.
And I think it's really difficult to, I think for a lot of people, it's really difficult to recover because they look at, their bitterness is summed up as, well, it's the church, and it's just this kind of unnamed, impersonal organization. And you can't forgive an organization or an impersonal entity, right? It's people. You have to forgive people. You have to go through that process of saying, hey, they're flawed, they're human beings, whatever. And I think that's a hang up for a lot of people. Yep. But I love, too, what you're saying, because I think this came up in Richard's story, too. It's that seed of faith when you were young that it had planted roots in your heart that when you were old, you didn't stray from it, right? There's a proverb, and yep. And I think that that's such a powerful theme in so many people's lives as well. But you guys, you and Tom, made it to Westside Church, and you've been here now for, I don't know exactly how many years, but
Michael was two,
so 12. Do the math. Yeah, 12 years. And what has that experience been like? I described a little bit of how meaningful it's been to have you guys a part of this community, but what has this community meant to you, and how has it helped you guys grow your faith?
I think I can speak for both of us in that I think we found that sense of community here that I wished I'd had, that I never thought I'd go to a small church. In fact, I remember the first Sunday we drove here, and as we drove up and it was residential, I went, oh no, I can't do this. I've always been in big churches, and you can kind of get lost but get involved. But in small churches, it's like family. Everybody knows your business. And that's what my assumption was, but it's been in a good way. We have met great people here. We have felt surrounded. We have felt loved. We would call many of you our family, and would feel welcome to, stop by and knock on your door and not feel unwelcomed. We also found here, when we began, there was community groups going on. So we were a part of community groups. We hosted community groups. We were doing, going and singing carols at the detention center. There was real live activity, things going on that actually were touching people in an individualistic way, not just on this broad spectrum of, oh, this is this big church who's on TV and everybody knows them. It was where we are this small community church who's helping people on a day-to-day real basis. And that drew Tom and I in. We feel very loved and connected. And we want to be involved in things like that, because the way we look at it, like that family, those bosses that stepped up and helped me, they were to me what I want to be to other people.
Yeah, that's great. That was my shameless plug for the church. I just, you know, threw you a softball, you knocked it out of the park. So, you know, one thing is, again, I said this at the beginning, as it reflects upon, you know, you and Tom Bolth and who you guys are and all the different ways you've made an impact in individual people's lives. I wanted to know, how has your past experience that you just talked through, how has it inspired you? I think of all the people that you've taken into your house over the years, the young women that you've mentored, the, you know, not quite orphaned kids, but, you know, kids who have been through some real struggles that you guys have taken into your home. There's so many now, and really amazing stories of how you guys have kind of been there for a season of their lives and helped them, you know, through that process. And there's some amazing fruit that's come from that as well. But how has what you have been through inspired you to make so many sacrifices for others, as you guys have done over the years?
I don't know, Tom.
Tom's not up here.
Inspired me. It keeps us real, I guess. You know, it would probably be easy for me to just have found this great marriage, have found this great life. You know, I have a husband, I have two kids. Lori got the little brother she always wanted. And we could just sort of like drive off into the sunset and live happily ever after. And yet, it's like God just keeps reminding me, again, like what I said, of what I wanted, I have opportunities to be that to others. Of what the glimpse I got of God's goodness and grace and provision from whomever he uses reminds me to be that provision. And every person he has brought to our doorstep has been a blessing to us. I remember specifically Jacqueline, when Jacqueline and her two daughters lived with us for a while. And there was a time when she said to me, "Christy Lynn, you've taught me so much." And I looked at her and I said, "No, you've taught me so much." She taught me, this is going to sound funny, but she taught me to buy organic fruit because we deserved it. To sacrifice that little bit more money for something good for us. Whereas I grew up in such poverty that you always bought the cheapest because that was the frugal way to be. And sometimes it's okay to be a little bit extravagant. And so she taught me to look at where I could be extravagant and where it might be okay to be that. And Megan taught us so much. Megan taught us to love unconditionally. That truth isn't always about speaking the truth, but it's about being believed. Davion has taught us that anyone can be somebody's brother. Megan gave us grandkids. We're grandparents because of Megan. Christy is a never-ending blessing in our lives. So all I can say is we give because it gives us so much in return.
Well, and, you know, one of the things I love about your guys' story is, and this is why you mean so much to me as a pastor and as a church, because God is connected you to all those people through the church, mm-hmm. through different ministries or just people, you know, that you meet here in this community. And you guys have modeled for all of us just what it means to live like Jesus for these people and what it means to really live like community and in a family, make sacrifices for each other. And God has just blessed so many people through your hospitality and your willingness to make those sacrifices for people. And you've experienced, you know, the fruit of those activities as well. And I think it's just an amazing, wonderful story. But so talk to us. I mean, you're in grad school now, which is exciting and challenging, I'm sure, at the same time. But talk to us about, you know, the inspiration for that step in this memoir that you're doing. And what's that all about?
All I can say is God has no boundaries. I should not be in grad school, according to the way you get into grad school. Like I said, I did drop out of high school. And when I got divorced, one of the first things I did was I went back to Edmonds Community College and I earned my GED because that was very important to me as a young mom of a 10-year-old daughter to show her that you don't just give up, that you can go back and finish that. So I did get my GED. So I no longer had to lie that I hadn't graduated high school. But I never went to college. I never had that opportunity. And in writing my memoir over the last 10 years, which has changed many times, the first years I began writing it, I was writing it from a very angry heart, angry about the abuse that I had been. Anyway, yes. And then as I healed and forgave my father and forgave my ex-husband, it became more of a showing domestic violence as kind of why women stay, why they go back, why they get involved in the first place, especially if they've been abused as a child. And then showing how everything pointed to me not believing in God, and yet I still did. So that's becoming more of the theme of the book. And then it became prevalent that potentially this book would actually be a way to meet with and speak with women or young girls. And God began to tug at my heart. I volunteered at a community center teen girls group and shocked them all one night when I shared just a clip of my story, you know, because they assumed I was this, you know, wealthy white woman who had a perfect life. And then when I shared my story, they were just blown away. And God began to say, I want you to work with them. And I thought, well, who's going to let just a woman who, you know, barely has her GED come and speak or mentor or be with these young girls or women? And it began to be brought to my attention that I should go and get a degree in counseling and psychology, that having a master's in that would bring clout to the book and to potential speaking engagements and things. To which I said, that's not going to happen, because that would take like 8 years of my life, and I have a young baby at the time. I can't do it. So I kept telling God, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. I would look, I would search. I had heard you can get life experience credit. I looked. Most colleges will give you about a year's worth of your BA for life experience. Last December, we happened to be at my uncle's house. Some of you know him, Ron Ruthreff. And he's a professor at Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. And we were just chatting, and I mentioned how I had always wanted to go to get my master's in counseling psychology, but it just wasn't going to happen. And he listened, and he said, I know your story. He said, you need to go to apply to the Seattle School. So they have a life experience program. I applied to it. It was about an 8-month process. I had to create a curriculum vitae, which I did not even know what that word meant, I will be honest. Tell me a resume. I know that word. Anyway, a curriculum vitae of my life, and provide backup documentation as to why my life would equate to a 4-year bachelor's degree. 8 pages later, to which I found things later. Anyway, I wrote it. It was reviewed by an admissions counselor. He helped me make sure it was good. And then it was submitted to a panel. And then I had to write grad school level papers. I hardly wrote high school level papers. Anyway, I enlisted my daughter, who is a grad, student. She is the first to get a master's. She helped me learn the APA style and all those wonderful things, and I wrote grad school papers. And then I had to get recommendations, which Garth was one of my recommendations, and Valerie was one of my recommendations. And then I had to write more papers, 2 more papers they required of me. And at the end of 8 months, they finally told me that I was accepted into their program. I have 1 year of probation. If I get a 3.0 or above in this first year, then I can complete the program and I will get my master's with my life experience bachelor's. So that's what took me. But by the grace of God.
You just gave me a great starter question for future conversations. It's why does your life equate to a 4-year
BA? Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for sharing your story with us. I want to thank you for the inspiration that you are to our community. And I just want to end this by just agreeing together and just praying over this next season in your life, this exciting memoir that you're going to be putting out that we're all going to be getting a copy of and reading. And also this exciting adventure of getting your master's and all of that. Just believing that God's really going to use you in this next season of your life and all these things that you've been through, and just continuing to see his fruitfulness in your life as you've been so obedient and to walk with him and to stay faithful and on this track. And so thank you. Thank you for sharing. So God, we just want to bless our sister, Christy Lynn. We thank you so much for this story of redemption. God, a story of your faithfulness in her life, and a story as well of her willingness to work through so many of the bad hands that she was dealt, and God, to stay on course with you. And I thank you that you've used her in so many incredible ways to be a foundational figure in the lives of others, an inspirational figure in the lives of others. And I pray that you would continue to use her in doing so. I just pray that you would just rip the roof off of whatever limits that she's placed upon herself. God, that this next season would be just an explosion of creative ideas and opportunities that you lead her into. We just pray for your blessing in her life. We pray for your favor in her life. And we just pray that she would continue to tell us great stories of all the good things that you are doing in her and through her. And so your blessing upon her, we appreciate her. We just honor her this morning in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, Christy.